In this episode of Tucker Center Talks, I talk to Dr. Brett Ball. She's a former baller, Division I athlete at the University of South Carolina, who got to play for Coach Don Staley. Unfortunately, her athletic career came to an end when she got some disturbing health news that changed the trajectory of her life forever. She turned that turn of events into becoming a documentary maker, a media personality, and going on to earning her PhD in journalism and mass communication at the University of South Carolina. Currently, she's doing a postdoc at the University of Minnesota in epidemiology, and we are so grateful she is on our campus. Her interest in mental health and injured athletes and their relationship with their athletic identity and bodies have led her on what she calls the scenic route in her career, from athlete to sport media journalist to researcher. She has a strong interest in blending data and storytelling and a passion that you will hear come through in our conversation together. I really enjoyed talking with Dr. Ball. She is a visionary that is seeking clarity on how to blend her many talents to make a difference in the world. And I have no doubt she will do just that. You are listening to episode 61 of Tucker Center Talks with me, your host, Dr. Nicole Lavoie. Let's talk. Today, I am talking to Dr. Brett Ball. Welcome, Dr. Ball, to Tucker Center Talks.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I've been looking forward to this moment, just following you all for a past year. So thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So you're currently now a postdoc at the University of Minnesota. We're so excited that you're on campus and adding to our scholarly community and plugging into the Tucker Center team. And so just tell us how you got to the University of Minnesota as a postdoc.
Again, excited to be here. And I had what my former advisor used to call the scenic route. So I grew up playing basketball, and I knew that I wanted to play professionally. That was my goal. And ended up getting a scholarship to play for Coach Staley at the University of South Carolina.
Go Gamecocks.
Yeah, go Gamecocks. So, and this is back in 2011. So again, really excited to play for her. Shortly after starting there, I had some heart complications and was diagnosed with a heart condition. They told me that I could no longer play basketball or any other sport competitively again. And so, of course, that changed my life because I'm a hooper. Like, all I know is basketball at this point.
Yeah. What do you mean I can't play basketball anymore? Right. And I'm playing on one of the best teams in the country, and now I can't play?
Yeah. It was really tough. Our freshman year, I feel like that year was like a turnaround year for us in Coach Staley, the program, because we had our first 25 win season in a long time. And we went back to the Sweet 16, like the first time, like 20 plus years. So we went to the NCAA. And I think that year we also made it to the Sweet 16. Anyway, it was tough. I was really blessed for Coach to honor my scholarship. You know, as you know, sports, college basketball is a business, you know, so, hey, you know.
Yeah, she didn't have to do that, but that speaks volumes about her and her character in that program.
Absolutely. So from there, I really kind of, I guess, didn't have a choice. My mom was a coach too, and so she was very clear about, while trying to still help me like cope with the injury and I'm not being able to play, you know, she was like, hey, well, you know, you're not contributing on the floor anymore. So this is, you know, this is your new role. And so it was actually one of the best things that could have happened to me, because I was away from Mississippi, like 9 hours away from home. I didn't know anyone in Columbia.
Wow.
And so my team became, yeah, my family. So there were like the only people that I kind of knew. And so it worked out that I was still with the team. Through honoring my scholarship, I didn't really have much to do on the sideline except, you know, talk to athletic trainers and the media personnel that would come cover our games. And so the likes of LaChyna Robinson, Debbie Antonelli, I would have a lot of conversation with them because I'm just hanging out on the sideline. And so the media team came up with the idea of me being the team's embedded reporter. And that's when Ballin' with Brett was launched. I had no idea what I was doing. She handed me a camera that I did not even know how to turn on. What is this? I'm a hooper. Like, yeah, just go, you know, film the team.
Here you go.
Yes. Gave me a camera. didn't know what to do, but it was perfect because our team had the perfect personality. Like we had the rappers, we had the drama queens, we had the quiet people. So we was great content for a show. But in addition to that, my desire for research kind of grew. And I felt like, okay, research is kind of for nerds. You know, I'm a basketball player.
Yeah, that is not for me.
Right.
Mm-mm, no.
Exactly. Methodology? What? Literature? Are you kidding me? So I actually connected at that time. It was actually Coach Daly who actually recommended that I see someone. And I told her, I was like, oh, Coach, I'm not crazy. You know, I know exactly like where I am. And she was like, no, it's not about that. So I believe at that point, she was already like ahead of her time in terms of like mental health and understanding like the importance of it. And so from that connection with my sports psychologist at the time, she connected me with another mentor at South Carolina that got me into research. And so my first research project, I interviewed the survey on athletes' response to injury, because being around athletes and what we call the Doty Center, where we did our training, where we ate, study hall, obviously athletes come in with banged up ice packs on their shoulders, on crutches. I mean, barely making it. I'm like, what happened to you?
And are you okay?
Yeah, exactly. And are you okay? And then there are a couple of people that I knew that did not have like the physical injuries, but had been cut off from, had been injured and were also seeing sports psychiatrists. And some people were cut off. If they're injured from certain sports, their scholarships were a little bit different than basketball. So I was hearing about their stories. I was like, so you mean like you have to have like academic or other financial support in order for you to like finish school. And I was here like kind of on the full ride. So it kind of gave me perspective. The type of sport that I even play was still, you know, a blessing because the way like my scholarship worked out. So fast forward, my interest in research grew as well as the media. Like, so they're in tandem growing. I'm still trying to figure out my life outside of basketball and trying to figure out what's next. But there was at the time, I didn't have the word mental health for it, but I just knew I cared about injured athletes and how we transition out of sport. Felt like there was no resource kind of for someone like me because most people had exhausted their NCAA eligibility. So they were transitioning out. But for people like me who had career-ending injury as a freshman, I was barely in, and now I had to transition out immediately.
Yeah, and you have to figure out a whole new identity. Who am I if I don't get to play basketball? Like,
exactly.
And that is so hard.
It's so hard. It was so hard. And I just continue, like, of course, like my faith was the number one reason that got me through that difficult season. And then, like I said, my teammates and my support system at the time. And then so fast forward to the end of my college year, actually my sophomore year, we had a end of year meeting every year with coach and try to review like what is next. And I actually decided not to travel with the team anymore because I was just so frustrated with my life and where it was, what was going. And I'm like, I don't even know what it is that I want to do. And everyone else is getting their WNBA or professional basketball stock up, you know? So I took a liking again to the media area. SEC Network was coming about. And so they were looking for students and I got thrown on a camera. Mm. And I'm like, I don't even know what I'm doing, but I'm hearing the producer in my ear. It's like, hey, yeah, turn the camera left. Press zoom with your left thumb. And
which
I'm like,
left?
Oh, which left? And I'm like, oh my gosh, follow the play or follow the, you know, person who just scored, like don't follow the ball. It was just like, it was a lot, but it was.
How cool.
Yeah. And I learned a lot of like technical behind the scenes. Again, this is kind of feeding the storytelling theme that's going on in my life. At the same time, I towards the end of my, when I graduated, I got my first job actually was at Tyler Perry Studios. I was a set PA. It was one of the best experiences of my life. And then I started as a graduate assistant for Ole Miss women's basketball team.
Okay. Did you think you ever wanted to go the coaching route? Did you like your mom, following your mom's footsteps?
You know, I thought about that and I did one scouting report with our assistant coach, Coach Boyer. I think it was versus Alabama. And, you know, her scouting reports are just tough. I mean, it's just so, it's so, so detailed.
Right.
After that, I knew that was not for me.
Not for you. Okay. Yep. It's good to know.
Yeah, it was not my lane. And I felt kind of bad for that because I was like, that's a normal transition for most athletes to go into coaching is, you know, work. You're kind of reliving your athletic or athlete life, so to speak.
Yeah. And you love the sport and your mom's a coach and
yeah, exactly.
It's in your blood. But it wasn't. It was not for you.
It wasn't for me. And I felt again bad because if that wasn't for me, then I'm like, well, what is? You know, how do I still be around sports and but I'm not coaching, and I'm not really an X and O's type of person. I struggle remembering plays when I was playing. So drawing up a play, that's just give it to me. Just show me where to go.
Yeah,
I'll go from there. So I was at Ole Miss, loved it there. I was able to do Ballin' with Brett again. And again, the research thing kind of put to the side because I just didn't see a life in it, so to speak. Mm-hmm. I just didn't know what I wanted to research. I knew I was still passionate about injured athletes. And then as life experiences through the mental health aspect of it, and then more specifically, African-Americans role in that, or what it meant for African-Americans. So decided to pursue a doctorate. Again, my faith was really the driving force of this. I'm a hooper. I'm still a basketball player. Why am I going the research route? But it fueled my desire for understanding more. I mean, I think that's kind of what the root of research is curiosity. It's like you just want to know, and you got to figure out creative ways to do it.
Yeah. And we have coined a term on Tucker Center Talks called unapologetic me search.
Ah, yes.
Right. And everybody I talk to on Tucker Center Talks in one way, shape, or form is an unapologetic me searcher, whether they know they are or not. And then we just put language to it.
Mm.
And because that's, you know, that's what we know. And you research things you're interested in, or reflect your identities or your life path or your experiences or the difference you want to make in the world. So, all right. So you're doing your PhD in journalism and mass comm.
Yeah.
And then we'll get to your dissertation topic in a minute, but how did you end up at the University of Minnesota, and you're in the School of Epidemiology?
Yeah. It was crazy. I thought about that as well. When I first looked at the post, I was like, oh, there's no way, you know, this is, I'm communications trained. This is public health. And then I saw the overlap of weight-related problems. And I thought, okay, let me see how my interest in weight-related problems, because again, it stemmed from mental health, but obviously mental health is so broad. Okay, what aspect? Mm-hmm. Well, again, me being an athlete, also struggling with body image and body weight issues after not being able to play. While I didn't gain an immense amount of weight, I knew that with the weight that I did gain was not normal to like what I was used to seeing myself.
Yeah, your whole relationship with your body changes.
Exactly.
Like, who am I? Well, whose body is this? What does it do?
Where'd you come from?
Yeah.
How did you get here? You need to leave. But yeah, and actually shortly after my diagnosis, I met with my athletic trainer, and I thought I had like the worms because I was eating so much. And mind you, you know, as you know, as an athlete, you know, we're fed before practice. You know, we have snacks on the sideline, or we have, you know, things post-practice. We have food, we have access to food, and I'm hungry all the time. And so again, I'm gaining weight. And then with my diagnosis, I could not exercise. Like there was a lot of like—
Right, restrictions, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, with the diagnosis of my heart, like that's a quick thing. So if I'm going down, I can't just, you know, make a phone call. So I'm even nervous in my mind, like, okay, if I run too much, then, you know, what will happen? Maybe I will pass out. What if no one is there? And so it's all of this thing.
Oh, that's so difficult.
Yeah, going through my head. And so, yeah, so that my interest in body image and what it can do to the athlete's mental, really what was kind of the root of it. And so I thought, I would say, okay, well, it was weight-related problems related to body images included in that. Then I can then apply this to what I know. Mm-hmm. And then this is an opportunity to also learn. And so when I met with Diane—
And when you say Diane, you're talking about Dr. Diane Newmark-Steiner, who's like a world-renowned epidemiologist here at the University of Minnesota.
Yes. And so when I read her pedigree, I was like, oh my gosh, like it'd be great to be mentored by her to learn, you know, under her tutelage. And of course, I actually found the University of Minnesota and found you through following Nike on LinkedIn and was reading the newsletter about the body confidence sport. And I'm thinking, I'm looking at the timeline. I'm like, oh my gosh, like I was literally doing my dissertation in a similar timeline as the body confidence sport was going on. And so
being developed. Yeah.
And so I was like, this is perfect. And so that's when I reached out to you. I was like, I have to find this woman.
Yes. And when I'm like, we talked and talked and talked, and then you emailed me back and you're like, I think I'm coming to the University of Minnesota. I'm like, what?
Yeah.
This is so great.
It was awesome. It was definitely overlapping. So I talked to Diane about if I could work with, you know, the Tucker Center, or she'd be okay with me doing work. And she was for it. And like I said, I knew that I could grow working with Project Eat. understanding like how weight related problems relate to young adults and then what you all do in the sports specific space. It was just a perfect opportunity for me to grow. And like I said, I knew enough that I can make the connections. And that's something that I'm trying to learn in my life too. Like not everything has to overlap. Enough needs to overlap. And then the people like yourself and other mentors can help me get to where it is I need to go.
Yeah. Well, you're at a perfect place to marry all your different interests. And
yeah.
So let's rewind just a little bit to talk about your dissertation project, which was studying the effects of Instagram on the athletic identities of Black female athletes and their body image dissatisfaction or satisfaction.
Yes, yes.
Which is so interesting and so needed and really cutting edge. So what were sort of maybe two top line findings from this research, and what did people find interesting about it?
Yeah, for sure. So one of the findings were we looked at meta perceptions, so how other people perceive you.
So for those who don't know meta perception, if it's like how you perceive, I perceive you.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
And so that is like the root of internalization, which is also associated with what we see on social media. Mm. And so from a communications perspective, what other people think of us determines, you know, how we see ourselves as part of our self-concept. How do we define ourselves? And so we wanted to look at two groups of people, their coaches and their friends. Ooh. In this context, we limited their friends to their teammate or the athletic community.
Okay.
And so what we found is that they felt like their coaches desire for them to be smaller while their friends desire for them to be bigger.
Bigger, like physically bigger, stronger, more athletic?
Yeah, yeah. Bigger, stronger. Like they felt like they were okay with their weight size. Like, oh, like you can afford to gain more weight. Like you're fine the way you are. Hey, you can afford to put on. To where the coaches, they felt like they think that their coaches think they should be smaller. And we drew the conclusion that their coaches hold a voice of authority in their lives at that point. And a lot of times, well, all the time, their playing time is determined by their perceptions of their coaches and the way they should look or be physically fit in order to accomplish what they desire.
Right. That's so interesting. Cause like in basketball, especially because it's one of the most visible sports, especially you know, the Gamecocks are on national television all the time. And, you know, you have fans and commentators and people commenting upon the body all the time. Oh, she looks out of shape. She's not fit. She didn't train in the off season. Or, oh, she's put on muscle. And like all this commentary of even the professionals, let alone we don't hear what the coaches say and how that gets internalized by young women on a very visible stage. I love this line of work. So what, like, how did the athletes make sense of this?
And that's something that I want to do a follow-up study because it was from the survey, we were not able to get in depth of why they, you know, would prefer that their coaches, we just drew conclusions based off the research and the role that the coaches have in their lives. And then the role that their friends have too. They're at, you know, young, you have a lot of social influences, your friends, particular athletic friends, maybe can relate a little bit more like, hey, don't put up that much pressure on yourself. I understand I'm going through the same thing. And again, that's where my body of what I like, would like to continue to do research to understand why, you know, that is so.
It's interesting because, and I know you and I have talked about this in the past with our intersection of your research and interests in body confidence sport, which is we're trying to upskill coaches to change the culture of sport from the youth level to high performance. It's really needs to change across the spectrum of competitive levels. How do we upskill coaches to create a body positive, body confident climate where female athletes are more concerned about what their bodies can do, right? On the court, in the pool, rather than what our bodies look like. And coaches, what I've learned from this work, coaches unknowingly create these climates. They're not intending like, I'm going to create a climate where all my athletes feel horrible about their bodies and feel shamed and ridiculed and surveilled. But they do, you know, this ends up happening whether they intend it or not. And the feedback we've gotten with Body Confidence Sport is that there are cultural nuances that it's not the same for everybody. It's not the same for all athletes. It's not the same for all white athletes. It's maybe different for Black athletes, but not all Black athletes are the same. So there's so many things to unpack, which is what I am so excited for you. Hopefully to start, you know, picking that back up, because we do know there are cultural differences in terms of our identities. And you were studying that in your dissertation.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're absolutely right with the cultural differences, because we found that, research says that African-Americans or those from marginalized communities had a broader conceptualization of beauty and body size. Mm-hmm. Particularly, you know, African-Americans are more accepting of larger body sizes. You know, we have our big mamas or, you know, aunties who, you know, we just, I would say love on, but that is just common in our culture. So to be, you know, a bigger size is like, hey, we accept that. That is like, that's the standard. And that's what also I found in the research is, based off the research, we say, hey, social media is driving people to depressive symptoms. They're having all these negative impacts based off internalization. And I said, okay, well, if this is the case, then does this work the same for African-American females who have, who again, are in this group, which consume social media, particularly Instagram, particularly its visual nature? Does their cultural and athletic identity serve as a buffer to internalizing these images? Do my acceptance of larger body sizes or a broader conceptualization of beauty buffer me from having these internalizations? But I have an athletic identity too. I have a particular way.
You have a body, and your body does things athletically, which is part of your identity.
Exactly. And most of the times, if I'm participating in any sport, I can't, there's a particular body shape that you know, kind of have in order to be able to perform at my optimal level. And so when I found that there was no connection, there was no results to cultural athletic identity, to body image dissatisfaction for Black female athletes, I think, you know, it makes me question, like, well, it's not that they're not affected at all, but how are they, or why, and what other factors are at play?
Right.
To have a negative, you know, body image dissatisfaction. And that's where I kind of am now, is wanting to continue my work to figure out, to further studies and maybe more of a qualitative study to find out why. And are these legit cultural barriers or buffers to body image dissatisfaction?
And what I know, you know, we'll just speculate here.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
What do you think you will find when you talk to Black female athletes mm-hmm. about this? What do you suppose?
Yeah, I just, out of speculation, I think there are other things, given the context of where we are, that is beyond culture and athletic identity. I think it has something related to political nature. I think it is maybe socioeconomic status that may be mm-hmm. at play. And obviously that was one of the limitations of my research, looking at own cultural and athletic identity. These are only two factors. So I'm thinking that, again, speculating that the political nature of the context of where we are now may have a, you know, may play a role in that. So I don't know. We'll see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Stay tuned. I'll be super excited. So as you're now in epidemiology here at the University of Minnesota and working with some really awesome colleagues, tell me, what are you working on right now that you're excited about?
As we talked about before, our research is research. And I just have a particular affinity for young African-American adults, particularly females. And so I'm looking at if physical activity could be a buffer between social media and depressive symptoms.
And can you give us a teaser what you're finding?
As a preliminary as results, and this is work I'm working with Project EAT, some preliminary results found that physical activity is not a buffer between social media and depressive symptoms. And like I said, we're going to go back and to rerun some tests, but it actually shocked me a bit.
Yeah, because you were thinking it would.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
And it's not.
is not. Yeah, several literature on physical activity and connection to depressive symptoms. Social media is also connected to sedentary behavior. So we're thinking, hey, if you're up and running and you're moving around, this will create a buffer effect for you reaching this particular outcome. And as again, I'm particularly interested as it relates to African American female athletes. So we'll see. I'm still working on it, and it's just
Okay.
I'll keep.
Maybe there's something else going on and
Yeah.
it's not that.
Right.
And just for people that are not familiar with Project EAT, can you just give us a couple sentences explaining what that is?
Project EAT is part of Diane Neumark Steiner. Her work is actually one of the longest longitudinal studies that she has conducted since 1998, has followed individuals from Minnesota in tracking their eating behavior and different aspects of the eating behavior. And I think it's pretty cool to see the evolution of that type of work to understand how to be able to create better resources for young people and see their habits in the ecosystem that contributes to the way we eat, the way we exercise, and the physical activity in general. So yes, Project EAT, please, if you get a chance to, maybe we could put a link.
Yeah, we can put that in the show notes. It's a massive body of work. And it's just reminding me I need to make a note to get Dr. Neumark Steiner on here to talk about it herself.
Yeah.
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 Okay, so you're working on that. Is there another? I know as a postdoc, you're probably involved in a lot of different projects. Is there another one you're particularly excited about?
Actually, yes. So as I mentioned earlier, I'm also, well, I made it didn't say this exactly, but my interest in media, sports media. I am working on relaunching Ballin' with Brett to focus on women athletes and women's sports. In addition to working on a documentary, storytelling is the heart of who I am and all my research project. And I think we talked briefly about it. I don't have a working title right now, but I really want to focus on how, from a public health perspective, how body image affects women's health, in particular Black females. And so looking to create a documentary, produce a documentary from that. And yeah.
That sounds cool. So, are you going to stick with Balling with Brett, or are you going to rebrand Balling with Brett? And when is that coming to fruition so we can all tune in?
I'm rebranding it to focus on to be a little bit more reflective of where I am. I thought about the name just really kind of stuck with me. It was given to me and
Great name.
yeah.
I mean, here's the thing. As a basketball player with a name like Ball as your last name, you cannot make that up.
I know. A lot of people are like, okay, what's your real last name? And I'm like, it's like
Ball.
it's Ball. So I decided to, and it's one of those things like it never left me. Like it always found me, so to speak. When I tried to get away from it, I was like, oh, it's a thing of the past. Like it's in college, it was the behind the scenes of the women's basketball team, and it's not that anymore. It is my launching. It was part of my story, but now it is as a storytelling platform that is, I say, is informed by research, empowered by athletes, and inspired by stories. And
Ooh, say that again. That's sticky.
they're sticky.
That's
Oh,
sticky. I like it. One more time for those in the back row.
yes, it is. Ballin' with Brett is a storytelling platform that is informed by research, empowered by athletes, and inspired by stories. So,
Let's just have a pause here. That's so good. So good. Okay, so you are early in your career. As a just finished your PhD in 2023 and now postdoc at the University of Minnesota, and you're sort of just finding your journey. What advice would you give to young women who might be listening to this and say, oh, wow, like you said, it was the scenic route,
yeah.
which is a great route. So, what advice would you give?
This can sound very generic, and but it's so related. Like I feel like it's so powerful. But chart your own path. Chart your own path. And I feel like we're in a era in life, or just the world. Despite, of course, we have barriers like this. I'm definitely not trying to ignore that. But we are at a place where we can chart our own path. And what I mean by that is there's no necessary rubric for success. There are principles, but there's no rubric for success because I never in my life imagined that I would have a PhD, that I'd even be talking to you. But I also felt like if I was a researcher, then I had to abandon me being a ball player. Like I would never not be a ball player. Always.
Yeah, they're not mutually exclusive.
Yes, they're not mutually exclusive. And I remember Flajie Johnson releasing a song called The Best of Both Worlds. And she talks about her basketball ability to fulfill her basketball dream and then her ability to still continue her music career. And I thought it was very perfect because we grow up in a society where we have to choose one or other, or people like box you in. If I'm honest, I'm still in so many ways kind of struggling with that because I'm like, am I a researcher or am I a storyteller? Am I a producer, director, or am I?
You're all of the above.
Yeah. And so trying to, again, shout out to you with your public scholar workshops that I really, really enjoy because it's helping me merge the two and articulate that. I still have some work to do. I still need to workshop it as I'm, like you said, emerging as a scholar and trying to establish like who I want to be remembered as. So my advice would be to, chart your own path and be confident in that path because there are principles in which, again, you should follow, but there's no particularly perfect way and you can have the best of both worlds or all of the worlds that you want to be part of.
Absolutely. And, you know, ironically, Brett, if you would have asked me early in my career, would I be running a research center at a large research-based university and be the director of said research center, I would have said, you have lost your mind. I mean, I thought I would be a teacher coach at a small liberal arts school. Research was sort of not interesting to me at all. I didn't see myself as a researcher. But, you know, now that I understand that data can make an impact, that was my way into the research. But you just follow your heart, your vision.
Yeah.
And be creative and merge your many, many talents that you have together and chart your own pathway. I love that advice. Love it.
Yeah, I'm still trying to follow it myself, but that's what I would, as I'm also on this journey, I'm encouraging from a place of where I'm also myself, and it doesn't happen overnight. So.
No, it does not. And I think a lot of young women that I work with on the Tucker team, they think, you know, it's this linear path. You know, I'm going to start here and I'm going to end there. And it doesn't work like that. And as soon as you can let that go and trust the universe and, you know, work hard and, you know, do all the things, the values that you said lead to success and trust it'll work out.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. It's not linear. Okay. This has been so fun to learn more about your research and all the different dimensions of what you're doing. And we're so lucky to have you here at the University of Minnesota. We're going to end with a speed round of questions. Ooh. There's going to be three questions.
Okay.
No right or wrong answer.
Alrighty.
All right. What is at the top of your playlist right now?
Oh, speed. Be quick. oh, gosh. I would just say Maverick City Music.
Okay.
Maverick City Music.
Okay. Who is your favorite badass woman right now?
Oh my gosh. Speed, Brett, be quick. Right now, will it be biased to say Coach Staley?
No.
Can I put two in there?
Yes.
Yeah, I just have to say my mom. Like I have to put her in there because Yeah.
Mom and Coach Staley. I think that's a good duo.
Yeah, duo.
All right. Okay. All right. Last question. Who is a influential woman scholar that has been impacting your work?
Okay. I would have to say Dr. Akila Carter-Francique. She actually was, I read her dissertation before I even got started in mine, and she did work on Black female athletes. And that was really kind of, she laid the foundation. I've been following her ever since. Yeah.
We could also put her under favorite badass women because she is. And she's been a guest on the podcast. She's been part of our distinguished lecture series.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
I just really admire the work that she's done. And so if you're listening, Akila, we're big fans here on Tucker Center Talks. Okay, Dr. Brett Ball, it's been such a pleasure to have you on Tucker Center Talks.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
And that is a wrap. Be sure to check out our many free evidence-based resources on our website at tuckercenter.org and follow us on LinkedIn, Facebook, or Instagram. This podcast was produced by Tucker team member Lindsay Hofer. Thank you, Lindsay, and thank you for listening to Tucker Center Talks. As we wrap, give yourself grace, support others, and let the data tell the story in ways that help us all accelerate systems change for girls and women in sport. I'm your host, Dr. Nicole Lavoie, signing off to make a difference in the lives of girls and women in sport.